Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero and the case to bring his killers to justice. But first, a look at changes in environmental policies on local, state, national, and international levels. With us is Astrid Carapetasso. Astrid Carapetasso is assistant professor at the Political Science Department at the University of Freiburg. She's the author of The Greening of Free Trade and co-editor of Climate Resilient Development. Welcome to the Scholars Circle, Astrid Carapetasso. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks, Maria. It's great to be here.
So you've been studying environmental policy, sustainability, climate change, NGOs. That I thought we should talk about some of the things that you found. One of the things that I've noted from your work is this idea of diffusion, because so many of the policies, environmental policies, look the same. How does this happen?
Yeah, that's true. That's why I got interested in the topic as well, because worldwide you see a convergence of policies, and so they become similar. And the question is, yeah, that's a good question. How does it work? You got a lot of networks, global networks being around, exchange between governments, so bilateral relationships, but also like sort of interregional, like the EU dealing with other countries, either on a bi-regional level or also with regard to, for example, EU-ASEAN. How does it happen? It's difficult to say. It's a tricky research agenda because you can find correlations between the policies and you can try to work your way through and find out who talked to who about the policies. And actually what I wrote about China was that China was really interested in getting some ideas how they could deal with their environmental problems. So there was a regular exchange, and they looked for other countries regarding best practice. And
I hope nobody's looking at Donald Trump's policies.
Well, he hasn't had any really good ideas so far. So.
Ideas, yes.
Yeah, well, he always needs Congress to support him. So you've just seen that. I mean, that can be a tricky issue for him. So we hope the best for the environment and climate change then. So, but I think actually with the United States, I'm not an expert on this, but it's quite interesting to see that on the sub-state level, you've got a lot of best practice and really good ideas. So California would be a very good example for that. And also that this triggers further cooperation among the states, so which is quite good. So the question is, do changed federal policies have a real impact on the state level or not? So this is a thing you have to see. But also like upstate New York was pretty tough on fracking issues. So you could hope for other initiatives. So
yeah, right. So I wonder also, you're talking about, for example, EU climate strategies being one of them that are inspiring others. Are these superior policies on climate? Are there something that, you know, other countries should be following?
I think you have to contextualize it, and this is what a lot of countries do. So they look for new ideas and see whether you have front runners. And the EU always wants to be the front runner because it has got quite a strong mandate in terms of climate action. As a European, you could also say, okay, we could still do better. But it's a start, and it's quite ambitious. And I think like Asian countries, for example, they look at these policies and figure out how it would work for their countries. Like, I mean, emission trading scheme is also quite a good example that some countries adopted, including New Zealand. The question is always, and we come back to the diffusion thing and convergence, is do they also learn from the mistakes made by others? Because obviously the emission trading system did not work too well in the European Union in the first run. So they made adjustments. And so when other countries look at these policies, for example, and think about their own countries, they have to figure out whether they could do it another way. So, and I think that's really important.
I know that one of the things that you have been looking at is the environmental NGOs and community groups and other non-governmental entities. What is the role that you think they're playing in all of this?
I think they are quite important players because for several reasons. So on the one hand, they often have a very good expertise in various issues because they focus on these issues. So they don't have a whole bunch of things they have to look at, even though if you look at environmental NGOs and what they do, it's quite a lot. So they can gather information and also make governments accountable for their action. So they're really important watchdogs to see whether the government does it the right way or not. And also that the means they have, like legal action, informing the public, and also that they, to a certain extent, represent the public. So some of their concerns, some of their interests. I mean, you can challenge that, but in general, I think it's not a false thing to consult with them. It's just a matter of who do you consult with, and I think that's the trickiest part of it.
You gave a talk here. You talked a little bit about the deep history, mm-hmm. and I was quite surprised at how far back some of these environmental movements, when they began. Can you give us a little bit of that history?
It started quite early in the 19th century, and even longer back in history, they realized that, for example, cutting down trees in an unsustainable way is not the way it should go, because otherwise you don't have any resources anymore. And in the 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution, that was quite an issue, because you had air pollution, and that was pretty hard, and people suffered from it. And so you had this on the one side, and also you had the conservation side, so that they realized, actually we are losing some of our valuable resources and also like species. So they tried to protect that. And so therefore the environmental movement has quite a long history.
You used a couple of phrases during that talk that I thought were quite interesting. One was intellectual competition. Mm. What did you mean by that?
Well, intellectual competition in terms of what I've just said, in terms of having their expertise. So mostly it's sound research that they do and scientifically based. And so they come up with alternatives. So, I mean, as you know, research and science is a contested field. So you need different solutions to different problems. And if you have sort of a biased focus, sometimes it's good to have a different perspective on it. So this is probably what I meant by intellectual competition.
Do you think that it's partly these NGOs that have made the diffusion process happen, why there are some similar policies as well?
Actually, no.
You don't?
Well, some of them, so like conservation activities, I think that's really good in terms of cross-country and transboundary cooperation. But I think the major policies in terms of, like, let's say, air quality, transport, climate change, etc., are finally made by governments. So it's actually the exchange governments have, but NGOs can really help to promote the alternatives that they have. And what they can do is they can exchange best practice also on the local level. And I think that's quite crucial, because in the end, someone has to implement all the ideas and all the policies. And where is it done? On the local level. So it's good when you have the NGOs networking, and also on a global scale, to exchange information about government policies. So to have a strong political leverage on the international level as well.
Do you think that they played a role in the trade agreement starting to get a little bit greener? I know this is a topic you researched a long time ago, but was that one of the factors in driving environmental sustainability into some of these trade agreements?
I think there were various factors involved, but certainly one was that they had a good exchange with government officials on this. So it played one role. It's not the most exclusive one, I would say, so that it was that single reason why they pushed for environmental agreements, in addition to New Zealand's green and clean image, which is suffering a bit at the moment, given the OECD report that's recently been released. But I think there was a wider awareness of environmental issues. I mean, all the side agreements I worked on in the past, they are binding agreements, but you don't have sort of a dispute settlement mechanism dealing with these issues. So that might actually change, because I had a look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I worked on that long time ago, and it wasn't that important. Now it got really important, and actually the clauses they have on the environment, they are again binding, and you can also challenge it. So there are some changes, I think, and it certainly has to do with the fact that also the World Trade Organization has a long trade and environment history. So they moved it a little bit in terms of framing towards more climate change. But the agenda is basically the same. And there have been arguments about trade disputes and the environment. And so this goes hand in hand a little bit. And also the country itself maybe has a better understanding of what it means for the environment if you increase free trade.
Finally, I wanted to get a sense from you if you think that these policies, both the international ones related to trade and these others that are being diffused out and copied from one another, are we doing enough?
That's a good question. I think you can always do more. When you see how the world looks like, and also, I mean, the climate negotiations have been there for a very long time, and it's a lengthy process, and it's pretty slow. I'm quite pleased to see that quite a lot of action actually happens on sub-global levels. And also, for example, the cities have realized that they should have a stronger position in international negotiations and relations, and they have their partnerships and exchange knowledge and best practice. And I think there's still more room to do more. So we'll see how it will work out. Hopefully, policies get more ambitious.
Well, Astrid Karapetasio, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for inviting me.
Astrid Karapetasio is assistant professor at the Political Science Department at the University of Freiburg. She's the author of The Greening of Free Trade and co-editor of Climate Resilient Development. When we come back, we'll explore the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero and the case to bring his killers to justice. Stay tuned.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Flora Moulton, blind street singer from Washington, D.C., talks about her music and sings, "I Can't Stand It," from this 1976 WPFW interview.
I wrote this song one night. Now, I want to tell you something about that, my songs that I write. I write songs about myself, and I write songs about history of things then. I can't stand it. I can't stand it.
This recording is part of American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publication and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
The dream that people can govern themselves, that we don't need princes or popes or high muckety-mucks priests of any kind telling us what to do and making decisions for us, is now over 200 years old. And it is extraordinary how plangent that idea still is after 200 years. All over the world, people are willing to die for that dream.
Molly Ivins, American newspaper columnist, humorist, and liberal commentator from Texas. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982.
When we talk about the contributions that poor women, poor black women made, we're not supposed to acknowledge them as having been agents of history. And certainly not of having played a role in shaping what we might call feminist historical traditions.
Angela Davis, African-American civil rights activist, author, and professor of the history of consciousness at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. For more information, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In 1980, the Archbishop Oscar Romero was gunned down while giving Mass in a Salvadorian chapel. For 3 decades, his killers ran free, but a small nonprofit organization called the Center for Justice and Accountability filed a civil lawsuit against one of the alleged killers and won a multimillion-dollar judgment against him. Matt Eisenbrandt, one of the lawyers on the case, has written a book about the assassination and the case. Matt joins us now. Matt Eisenbrandt is the legal director of the Canadian Center for International Justice and the author of Assassination of a Saint, The Plot to Murder Oscar Romero and the Quest to Bring His Killers to Justice. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Matt Eisenbrandt. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about this really fantastic book, Assassination of a Saint. I thought what we should do is start with the context of what was going on in Latin America and particularly in El Salvador during this time before the assassination and leading up to it. How would you describe it?
It's a convergence of the Cold War with a lot of changes in the Catholic Church, I would say. In particular, there was a real worry by the United States government and by right-wing governments throughout Latin America, particularly military dictatorships, about insurgencies in their countries and a worry in the Cold War context that those countries might fall to left-wing governments. And at the same time, the Catholic Church had undergone quite a revolution of its own, and particularly in Latin America, having a focus now on the poor, the majority of people in those countries. In particular, that played out with a much greater focus on not on charity, but instead on looking at the factors in society that had led to such inequality, and therefore an attempt to empower people and communities to change the situations in their countries. And in particular in El Salvador, that led to immense resistance from those who wanted to maintain the status quo and led to violent suppression of the church and people associated with the church.
I had read that the Civil War there claimed something like 75,000 civilians' lives. Is that about right?
That's about right. I mean, there's you know, some difference in the numbers, but that is the one that most people use.
Now, you noted in the book about the coffee sector and the role that it played there, the inequalities it produced, particularly with the campesinos. How did that system work and how did it contribute to this?
Without going into the entire history of it, essentially at the end of the 19th century, there was a great change in landholding in El Salvador and other parts of Central America, where there was an outlawing of communal lands, particularly indigenous land, and a privatization of large estates. And this was in part through liberal economic policies that also, you know, sort of came around the same time as coffee was booming and coffee required these sorts of estates. And it led to a concentration of land in the hands of very few, while campesino communities were dispossessed of land and forced to work on the larger estates. So this led, you know, throughout the 20th century then to a consolidation of economic power in the hands of a small collection of families in El Salvador to the detriment of the larger population.
And then there was a rising of social movements starting around, 1977, 78. What was that like?
And I would say it dates back before that, but really came to a head in the late 1970s in that time period. After great widespread repression and mass killings in 1932, there were a few decades that passed of military rule where there was not a real consolidation of outward calls for reform. And in the 60s and into the 70s, there was finally a renewed movement in essentially every sector of society. Teachers' unions were formed, campesino groups, you know, any area of society you can think of, there were open calls for reforms. And by the late 70s, those groups, the popular organizations, as they were known, were able to, you know, shut down different sectors of cities on any given day through marches and protests and takeovers of buildings. But these were still done in a way where these groups were not calling for a violent overthrow of the government, but instead were calling for reforms, government reforms that would improve the situation in the country.
Did the U.S. play a very major role during this period of time?
Well, yes and no. Certainly, the U.S. role was not as large as it was in the 1980s once the Civil War had started and the Reagan administration was sending hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid. But the United States government, even in the 70s, was still always the elephant in the room. Starting in the 60s with the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration, the U.S. was training the Salvadoran military and other Latin American militaries in counterinsurgency and how to essentially fend off the possibility of a Marxist insurgency. And that military training actually helped lead to the formation of the death squads that we saw in the 60s, but much more prominently in the 70s and 80s. So although I would say that in the late 70s, the U.S. role perhaps was not quite as strong as it would be in later years, you know, the U.S. government was always a looming presence.
So now let's talk about the Archbishop himself. Now, he was chosen, as you noted in your book, because he was not thought to be somebody that would really create problems in El Salvador for the ruling elite. But things started to change. How would you describe that whole period?
When Romero was chosen as Archbishop, the Catholic Church was so important in El Salvador that the Vatican actually consulted with the military government and with members of the oligarchy of the wealthy families to get their input on who should be the new archbishop. And their choice overwhelmingly was Romero, whereas many of the priests working in communities who were practitioners of liberation theology were not in favor of Romero because, as you say, he was seen as someone who probably would not, you know, rock the boat. What I would say is that Romero went through an evolution whereby he became much more outspoken. It's not that he was entirely against the changes that were going on in the Catholic Church before he was Archbishop. He certainly had views about Marxism that he had expressed before on certain topics like that. But it's not that he was entirely recalcitrant. In 1977, just 3 weeks after he became Archbishop, his friend and fellow priest, Rutilio Grande, was murdered by a death squad linked to the military. And in Rutilio Grande's death, there's some public mythology that Romero had a conversion. And I'm not sure that is really true. But I do think that it sped up his evolution and made him far more outspoken against abuses. And Grande's death did cause him to say, I will not participate in government events, you know, until his murder is solved, which, of course, it never was. No one was held accountable for it. So from that day forward, Archbishop Romero stopped cooperating with any government functions, did not participate. And so I think that's the transformation that he went through, to becoming much more outspoken and sort of understanding that it was necessary for him to play that role to protect not only his priests, but also to protect the vast majority of Salvadorans who were being oppressed.
You noted at the very beginning of the book, there was a passage about how he was targeted for assassination. And you noted advertisements and the significance of typeface. And why was this important?
Well, in El Salvador at that time, paid advertisements in the newspaper were a form of political speech, an important form of political speech. And it's quite stunning to go back and read those, because there would be, you know, full page ads taken out by different groups. And sometimes they were the popular organizations. Sometimes they were groups representing landowners' interests. And they would be, you know, sort of large statements laying out political views, and in some cases, very directly denouncing and attacking individuals or groups. And so there were paid advertisements, Campos Pagados, that were targeting Romero and the church more generally for being communists, for being traitors, for even being terrorists. And so this was an important form of, I don't know if you even want to call it political speech, but just for shorthand, we'll say that. And it sent important signals to different sectors of society, you know, about how individuals and groups should be portrayed.
He was killed just after calling on members of the military to not obey the dictatorship, but God's law. And he had also taken on the Supreme Court. So he was taking a lot of risks. Did he have a sense that he might pay for this with his life?
The risks that he took are indescribable. Romero knew that he was likely to be killed. There's no doubt about that. He received hundreds of death threats, very detailed letters. He was denounced regularly on TV and elsewhere. And he himself, though, he did not shy away from what he felt were his religious and theological obligations. And he, as you say, he denounced, he did not talk in general terms. He talked in very specific terms. He denounced the Supreme Court when he felt like they were not upholding the interests of justice. He denounced military leaders. He called, for example, on the Minister of Defense in 1980 to resign. He called out one of the key death squad figures, Roberto Davison, who was eventually involved in his murder. He called out the oligarchs very specifically and said that, you know, they were the cause of the problem. So I think the general knowledge about Romero's murder was that it was carried out because of his criticism of the military. And certainly that is true. But he did not limit his denunciations and critiques to the military, but also delivered them against what he saw as the other recalcitrant sectors of society, including the wealthy landowners and business people.
So let's now turn to the Center for Justice and Accountability, which is the organization that filed the lawsuit that your book is based around. You were, what, 26 when you joined the organization? How did you come there?
I had been out of law school less than a year and was working doing immigration and refugee work in Los Angeles. And an opportunity for a staff attorney position opened up at CJA. And at the time, they were looking for somebody who was admitted to the bar and who spoke Spanish and had some background in immigration because of a particular case that they were working on at the time. You know, the stars aligned and I was able to get that job. And by that time, CJA was already looking into the Romero case sort of on a preliminary level because the year before they had discovered one of Romero's killers living in California, Alvaro Saravia. And so by the time I joined CJA, that investigation was already open and then took off quite a bit in the following year, in part after the conclusion of another important El Salvador case, which was against two former ministers of defense, the one I just mentioned, General Garcia, who Romero called on to resign, and his successor, General Vitas Casanova. There was an important trial against them, a judgment against them for the torture of three Salvadorans who now lived in the United States. So it was the verdict in that case that really opened up the other El Salvador work for CJA, and that was the moment at which I was coming into the organization.
How did you find out about Saravia being in California?
Well, there were two important events in 2001 that happened. The first is that a Salvadoran man working with CJA actually went into a law office in San Francisco and saw Alvaro Saravia sitting in the law office and knew who he was. So that was an important and amazing revelation. And then later in 2001, the Miami Herald newspaper ran an article about torturers and war criminals living in the United States. And one of the people that the paper mentioned was Saravia, mentioned his involvement in Archbishop Romero's assassination, and then very critically indicated that he was living in Modesto, California, just a few hours away from CJA's headquarters in San Francisco. And so those two pieces of information were what led CJA to really start looking into the Romero case.
Did you have to go find a plaintiff, or was there already a plaintiff?
Well, there was interest in injustice in Archbishop Romero's case, and our client in the case is someone whose identity has been protected and filed the case in the name of J. Doe. It is a relative of Archbishop Romero, and that person sought the court's permission to proceed in the case anonymously, and so was able to do that throughout the case. But that being said, you know, that person obviously brought the case. I talk in the book about us being the legal team and our work on the case, and I don't talk much about the plaintiff, but that's intentional because of protecting that person's identity. But needless to say that the case, although we were acting on that person's behalf, the case was brought by that specific relative, J. Doe.
I was curious about how the plaintiff comes about coming to CJA, given the rest of the case and how it developed.
Right. I was just going to say that obviously we partnered with, you know, key figures in El Salvador who had connections. And, you know, we obviously had discussions with those people who then had the right connections and knew the lay of the land. And obviously, you know, a relationship was able to evolve through those contacts.
In doing the investigation, and this was quite fascinating reading all the details of how this went on, you had somebody who was sort of an insider. You had a getaway car driver. How did these come about?
Through, you know, through hard investigation, through amazing support from people in El Salvador, and through quite a bit of luck, you know, as these things often go in investigation. You know, we put together a plan. I should say our investigation during essentially the 1 year that the case was active, our investigation was focused on finding evidence against Alvaro Saravia, who was the defendant in our case. But in fact, we already had quite a bit of that through documents and through some earlier testimony. But we were trying to investigate the support structures of the death squad that killed Romero. So in other words, our interest was trying to look up the chain of command, if you will, to those above Saravia who might have been financing death squad operations or involved in death squad operations or supporting that death squad from above. And so a big part of our investigation was attempting to find witnesses and evidence against those people. What ended up resulting was a few witnesses coming forward and providing information on that front, combined with some of the documents that we already had. In terms of the driver himself, he had testified in 1987 secretly that he had been the driver for the assassination, and then he disappeared. And we, you know, didn't necessarily think that we had to have him as a witness, but, you know, our judgment was, well, he's testified previously. And so perhaps if we can find him, maybe he'll be willing to testify again. And as I describe in the book, my colleagues on one trip to El Salvador decided to go to his hometown. And through an amazing set of coincidences that I lay out in the book, managed to determine that the driver was actually in the U.S. Witness Protection Program. And so through a number of steps in trying to gain access to him in the Witness Protection Program, we eventually got a big surprise when he contacted us and eventually agreed to testify in the case. And that was, you know, quite critical to have that sort of insider giving testimony on the record.
So he was the witness that called your co-counsel.
That's right. We had been trying to track him down through contacts at the Witness Protection Program, but obviously that's an organization that is whose role is to keep things secret. And so one day, completely out of the blue, after we had almost given up on the idea that we might be successful, he called my colleague and said that he was witness 5145. And it was from there that our relationship with him developed, and he eventually agreed to testify.
What about the process of actually tracking down Saravia and the others that you were investigating? What were the impediments that you faced in that?
The single biggest impediment in anything related to the Romero case is security. even today, 37 years later, El Salvador is an incredibly violent and dangerous place. And Romero's assassination remains a topic that is dangerous to speak about. So trying to access witnesses or trying to track down our descendant who was on the run was the biggest hurdle, was trying to get information where it might be dangerous for people to share that with us. And obviously, you know, in the book, I talk about our investigation a bit from the perspective as U.S. lawyers working on this case, but we worked in conjunction with several, you know, amazing people in El Salvador, some of whom are named in the book, some of whom are not, to protect their own security. And so we worked very closely with them and obviously took their lead on how to proceed in a country as dangerous as El Salvador. So even some of the witnesses that did come forward and that I do talk about in the book, I still don't disclose their identity. And in fact, as I mentioned early on, there's actually more, you know, there is more evidence and there are other witnesses that we spoke to that I can't even talk about. And so just by the simple fact of that, by me not even being in El Salvador and writing about an assassination that happened 37 years ago, it's still dangerous for people to talk about it or have their names associated with it. So I would say that, you know, that was the biggest difficulty that we had. Another one is certainly when you're coming from the United States, there is a natural distrust in El Salvador of people from the United States who might be looking into something like this, not just a distrust about whether there are any links to the U.S. government and the role that the U.S. government has played in El Salvador, but also the sense that there are plenty of, you know, people who have come down from the United States over the years who want to, you know, help or do good things in El Salvador and then, you know, haven't followed through or their work has had unintended bad consequences, things like that. And so there's a level of trust that has to be established with activists in El Salvador, with professionals in El Salvador, with witnesses when you're coming from the United States. And that was something that we had to work long and hard to achieve, not just in the Romero case, but in all of our El Salvador work.
Yeah, speaking of the United States, there were investigations both in El Salvador and in the United States, but they took different types of turns. How would you describe some of these?
They did. They all had different outcomes, and I do chronicle those somewhat in the book. So, for example, the first investigation started the day of Romero's assassination when a judge was, you know, assigned to look into the case. And 3 days later, the national police attempted to kill him and he had to flee the country and stay out of the country for the next 10 years. In 1987, when the driver secretly testified, the U.S. government at that time, through a series of complicated political reasons, was very supportive of trying to investigate Romero's assassination in El Salvador. And that led to the driver's testimony, which then caused Alvaro Sarabia to be arrested in Miami, where he was then living and had come with a U.S. visa. But in fact, his case, he was eventually let out of jail because the arrest warrant that was issued against him in El Salvador as a result of the driver's testimony made its way up to the Supreme Court of El Salvador, that was dominated by right-wing figures who invalidated the arrest warrant. And that was really the best opportunity ever for a prosecution in El Salvador. And that was all thrown out the window. There were other investigations that took place. An official at the U.S. Embassy actually spoke with Sarabia in 1990 and got important information about the assassination, but the U.S. government never followed through with that. In 1993, the UN-sponsored Truth Commission also investigated Romero's case and actually spoke with Sarabia, who again provided important testimony. And that case resulted in a very detailed report from the Truth Commission naming names. And 5 days after the Truth Commission report came out, the Salvadoran legislature enacted a sweeping amnesty law that was in place for the next 23 years. So you know, all of those different investigations had the potential to produce results, but, you know, in the end did not lead to any prosecutions in El Salvador.
Now, there were others that you also named in the book that sounded like they had really big roles in this. And one of them was a dentist who apparently used his tools to make particular kinds of bullets. And then there was another man, I think it was Roberto
Davison.
Davison.
Yeah, Davison.
So who were these people, and what role do you think they played in this assassination?
Well, Roberto Davison is an absolutely central figure, not just in the Romero assassination, but in the history of El Salvador. He had a military intelligence background, had gotten some training in the United States, and built himself into this sort of dual figure where he had a clandestine side where he was actually running a death squad, you know, and his people were carrying out targeted assassinations. But at the same time, he was a very public figure and a very public anti-communist crusader and created and founded the ARENA political party, which went on to be one of the most important political parties in El Salvador. In fact, was in charge of the government for a number of years. So Davison is a central figure and had, you know, a key role in ordering the assassination of Archbishop Romero. He actually died in 1992. So he was not an active suspect in our case because he had passed away many years before, but he is a central figure. And the judge in our case eventually concluded that he was the mastermind of the assassination. The other person you mentioned, the dentist, Hector Regalado, is also an important figure in the death squads in El Salvador, but he is somebody who was suspected for many years of being the shooter. And in fact, I don't think that is true. And the Truth Commission concluded that he likely was not. But he was very closely tied to Roberto Davison and had been his chief of security in the Salvadoran legislature. And so there were, you know, political reasons for trying to tie him to the assassination. The driver had identified a photo of him as someone likely to have been the shooter, but the photo was likely very old and had been tampered with. And so it's not clear that was, you know, an accurate identification anyway. So he's an important figure in the death squads in El Salvador, but not necessarily in Romero's assassination. There were other people who had been named, particularly by the Truth Commission, But you're right that they did not have connections that we knew of to the United States, and so weren't named as defendants. But what we did try to do, the case that we initially filed was against Saravia himself, and then we put in what were known as DOs 1 through 10. And those DOs were the people above Saravia that we hoped to be able to bring into the case as defendants, because we did have evidence that wealthier figures who might have been financing the death squad operations, did have homes in Miami, and there was evidence of death squad planning from Miami. And so that was something that we hoped to eventually include in the case were the names of some of those people.
The defense, what was the defense?
Well, so interestingly, there never actually was a defense. So maybe I can quickly explain. This was a civil lawsuit. It was not a criminal case because there were no laws in the United States that would have permitted a criminal prosecution against Saravia for a murder that happened in El Salvador. And the tool that was used at that time, in particular in the United States, was a law called the Alien Tort Statute, and then another later law called the Torture Victim Protection Act. And it allowed for civil lawsuits to seek basically money compensation against individuals who are involved in human rights abuses. And so the case that we were able to bring was a civil lawsuit against Saravia And although that's perhaps not a satisfying result in that nobody was going to go to jail, in fact, it ended up being helpful because Saravia disappeared. We never actually saw him in person, but because it was a civil lawsuit, we were allowed to proceed based on the fact that we had significant evidence tying him to a specific address in Modesto, California. And the court eventually found that that evidence was enough to, to allow the case to proceed in spite of the fact that we had not actually seen Saravia. And he ended up not entering a defense in the case and not appearing in the case. But we were nonetheless able to proceed to trial against him. But one of the central stories running through the book is our search for him, because we actually did want to find him, not only because, you know, we thought that the case would have more impact, you know, if he was actually, spotted and identified, but indeed that we knew that he had a lot of information about the death squad and powerful figures who financed the death squad. And we hoped that perhaps he would be willing to give us information, you know, about those people, perhaps in exchange for considering settling the lawsuit.
Let's move this a little bit broader now. You noted in the book that CJA, which is where you worked at the time, I know you're not there now, but it's part of a worldwide campaign to hold those who commit atrocities, whether it's torture, genocide, or war crimes. Who else would you describe as part of this worldwide campaign?
Well, there's a whole network now. Obviously, over the last 20 plus years, there's a series of international tribunals that have prosecuted people for genocide and war crimes. Now, including the International Criminal Court, there are government prosecutors in a number of countries now, in some Latin American countries, some African countries, in Europe, and in North America, who have now, prosecuted figures, implicated in these sorts of international crimes. There are nonprofit organizations, particularly prominently in North America, and a few in Europe that have pursued these cases, but also in other countries now that have more recently been very central, to legal actions to hold people accountable for these sorts of crimes. So, there are a number of NGOs, of, government prosecutors and other government figures, as well as those at international tribunals, all of whom are working toward accountability in these kinds of cases.
I know that you are in Canada working with a similar type of NGO, the Canadian Center for International Justice. How does what you're doing there in Canada compare to what you did for CJA in the U.S.? Do the legal systems compare? Is the work similar?
The work is similar in some ways, but some of the legal tools are different. So in the U.S. at that time, obviously, I mentioned that we were pursuing mostly civil lawsuits in U.S. courts against people who were living in the United States. In Canada, at least at the moment, if you pursued a civil lawsuit against, say, a government figure or a government itself, there will actually be immunity in Canadian courts, and those cases cannot be pursued at the moment. There is a better structure in the criminal laws in Canada that actually permit prosecutions of anybody who might be found in Canada who was involved in genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, or torture. And so we do have slightly better laws than the United States on that, although in spite of that, there have only been two criminal prosecutions here in 17 years. So the track record is somewhat mixed in Canada. A key difference, though, is, at least in terms of my personal work, is that at CJA, we were focused on individuals who were, responsible for torture and war crimes. In Canada, although I do still very much work on those cases, we are also involved in trying to hold Canadian corporations accountable when they're implicated in abuses in their overseas operations. So my organization is currently involved in two lawsuits in Vancouver involving Canadian mining companies, where there are allegations of one company's security personnel opening fire on peaceful protesters, and another lawsuit involving allegations of slave labor at a mine in Eritrea. So although that work is undertaken in the United States, and there are several wonderful NGOs that have been doing that kind of work for a number of years, I myself was not involved in that work too directly, whereas now in Canada, that is an important focus for us.
You also said in the book that there's no shortage of perpetrators. How big of a scope do you think we're really looking at?
Well, there are not necessarily precise figures. I know that, I think a number that was used in the United States was that there might be up to, 2,000, torturers or war criminals in the United States. And, there have been somewhat similar figures floated with regard to Canada. There are certainly government statistics about the number of prosecutions or citizenship revocation actions and deportation or removal proceedings against people for on grounds of their involvement in war crimes, torture, or crimes against humanity. And those, do run into the hundreds. So I do think that, both Canada and the United States certainly have been destinations over the years for people who might have committed these sorts of crimes overseas and then relocated to those countries. But of course, also, notoriously, the United States government itself has been involved in torture and in targeted killings. And the government of Canada has its own problems on that front, and particularly on involvement in torture in the fight against terrorism. So although the focus of many of these cases has been on these sorts of human rights abuses committed abroad, where people relocate to those countries. In fact, those governments, have themselves been implicated in these kinds of abuses.
Now, would you say that the Romero assassination investigations that happened, the case that you tried, do you think that there are bigger implications? It's one case. How do you see this in the big picture?
Certainly, I don't want to overstate what cases in the United States can do inside El Salvador, but I will say that CJA did have a strategy of pursuing, a handful of cases together as a way to not only seek justice for individual victims, but also to try to break the ice of impunity in El Salvador. As I mentioned, the earlier case against the two ministers of defense, the Romero case, and then we were involved in another jury trial in Memphis, Tennessee, against Nicolas Carranza, who was the operational commander of the Salvadoran Armed Forces in 1980, in the year that Romero was killed. And in El Salvador, people speak, very openly of the somewhat bizarre situation where a number of top commanders have actually been held legally responsible in the United States, and whereas nothing has been done at all in El Salvador. And now you can add to that there's a criminal case open in Spain involving the massacre and the killing of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper and her daughter in 1989. And you do see a cumulative effect of those cases putting pressure inside El Salvador. And again, I don't want to, overstate it, but certainly there is an impact. And in fact, the two ministers of defense who were found responsible in that first trial have since been deported by the U.S. government, are back in El Salvador, and have been, General Garcia, for example, has been named now as one of the suspects in the massacre at El Mozote, a case that is now in the Salvadoran courts. And so although any specific case on its own may have its limitation, there is a cumulative effect over time, and these things take a very long time to play out. But you can see a bit of a formulation of an impact through as a result of those cases. And certainly, I hope that the evidence that was developed in those cases can also be important now that the amnesty law has actually been removed in El Salvador. I hope that the evidence that was developed in the U.S. cases can now be used in Salvadoran courts.
Well, Matt Eisenbrandt, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for your time and for this really great book. It's called Assassination of a Saint.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Matt Eisenbrandt is the legal director of the Canadian Center for International Justice and the author of Assassination of a Saint, The Plot to Murder Oscar Romero and the Quest to Bring His Killers to Justice. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Poet Sylvia Plath with excerpts from a 1962 radio interview.
These peculiar, private, and taboo subjects, I feel, have been explored in recent American poetry. I think particularly of the poetess Anne Sexton, who writes also about her experiences as a mother who's had a nervous breakdown, as an extremely emotional and feeling young woman. And her poems are wonderfully craftsmanlike poems, and yet they have a kind of emotional and psychological depth, which I think is something perhaps quite new, quite exciting.
Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org.